Every minute or so, he was struck afresh by the revelation of how ludicrously lucky they all were just to be here. Satisfactory, as Lane had said.
"Where is it coming from, though?"
Holston asked.
"Is it where we thought it would be?"
Guyon just nodded, his face composed, but Holston felt a thrill of excitement go through him.
"It's there. It was real. All this time."
The Gilgamesh had not just cast itself randomly into the void to escape the end of all that they had left behind. They were one step short of being quite as suicidal as that. They had been following the maps and charts of the old empire, looted from failed satellites, from fragments of ship, from the broken shells of orbital stations containing the void mummified corpses of Earth's former masters. Vacuum and stable orbits had saved them, while the ice was scouring the planet below. And amongst the relics were the star maps, detailing where in the galaxy the ancients had walked. They showed him the signal, as it was distantly received by the Gilgamesh's instruments. It was a relatively short message, repeating interminably. No busy radio chatter of a bustling extrasolar colony. That would surely have been too much to hope for, given the time that had elapsed.
"Maybe it's a warning," Guyon suggested. "If so, and if there's some danger, we need to know."
"And if there's some danger, what precisely do we do about it?" Holston asked quietly. "Can we even change our heading enough now, without hitting the system?"
"We can prepare," Lane said pragmatically. "If it's some cosmic event that we somehow haven't picked up, and that somehow hasn't destroyed the transmitter, then we might have to try and alter course. If it's a plague, or hostile aliens or something, well, it's been a long time, I'll bet. Probably it's not relevant anymore."
"But we have the maps. Worst comes to worst, we can plot a course for the next world,"
Guyon pointed out.
"We'll just slingshot past their sun and be on our way."
By then, Holston had stopped paying attention to him and just sat hunched, listening by earpiece to the Gilgamesh's rendition of the signal, looking over visual depictions of its frequency and pattern, calling up reference works from their library. He adjusted the Gilgamesh's interpretation of the signal, passing it through all the known decoding algorithms that long-dead civilization had used. He had done this before plenty of times. All too often, the signal would be encoded beyond the ability of modern cryptography to unpick. At other times, there would be plain speech, but in one of those problem languages that nobody had been able to decipher. He listened and ran his encryptions, and words began to leap out at him, in that formal, antique tongue of a vanished age of wonder and plenty, and an appalling capacity for destruction.
"Imperial Sea," he declared confidently.
It was one of the more common of the known languages, and if he could just get his brain working properly, it should be child's play to translate it now he'd cleaned it up. There was a message there, finally opening like a flower to him, spilling out its brief, succinct contents in a language that had died before the ice came.
"What?"
Guyon started angrily, but Holston held up a hand for silence, letting the whole message play again and enjoying his moment of prominence.
"It's a distress beacon," he announced.
"Distress as in... go away?" Lane pressed.
"Distress as in come and get me," Holston told them,
meeting their eyes, seeing there the first spark of hope and wonder that he himself felt.
"Even if there's no one, and almost certainly there's no one, there will be tech. Functioning tech. Something waiting there for us for thousands of years. Just for us."
For a moment, this revelation was strong enough that their generalized low-level dislike of him almost vanished. They were three shepherds leading their human flock to a new promised land. They were the founding parents of the future. Then Guyon clapped his hands.
"Fine. Good work. I'll have the Gilgamesh wake key personnel in time to start deceleration. We've won our gamble."
No words said for all those left behind, who had not even been given the chance to play, or to wonder about the handful of other Ark ships that had taken different courses, the Earth spitting out the last gobbets of its inhabitants before the rising tide of poison overcame it.
"Back to your slabs, both of you."
There was still at least a century of silent, death-cold travel between them and the signal's source.
"Give me just half a watch awake,"
Holston said automatically. Guyon glared at him, remembering suddenly that he had not wanted Holston among key crew. Too old,
too fond of himself, too proud of his precious education.
Why?
Because it's cold, because it's like being dead, because I'm afraid I won't wake up, or that you won't wake me, because I'm afraid. But Holston shrugged easily.
Time enough to sleep later, isn't there?
Let me look at the stars, at least. Just half a watch, and then I'll turn in. Where's the harm?
Guyon grumbled his contempt at him, but nodded reluctantly.
Let me know when you go back. Or if you're last man up, then... Turn out the lights. Yes, I know the drill.
In truth, the drill was a complex double-check of ship's systems, but the Gilgamesh itself did most of the hard stuff. All of key crew were taught how to do it. It was barely more taxing than reading down a list. Monkey work.
Guyon stalked off, shaking his head, and Holston cocked an eye towards Lane, but she was already going over the engineering readouts, a professional to the last. Later, though, as he sat in the cupola and watched the alien starfield, 2,000 years from any constellations that his ancestors might have known, she came to join him, and sat with him for a fidgety 15 minutes without saying anything. Neither of them could quite voice the suggestion then, but by raised eyebrow and abortive hand movement, they ended up out of their ship suits and clasped together on the cool floor, whilst all of creation wheeled gently overhead.
Chapter 2.2 Earth's Other Children. The name she answers to has both a simple and a complex form. The simple form comprises a series of telegraphed gestures, a precise motion of the palps, conveying limited amount of information. The longer form incorporates a backing of stamping and shivering to add a subtle vibrational subtext to that crude flag-waving, varying with mood and tense, and whether she speaks to a dominant or submissive female, or to a male. The nanovirus has been busy, doing what it can with unexpected material. She is the result of generations of directed mutation, her presence mute witness for all those failures who never bred. Call her Portia. To travel the forest is to travel the high roads, branch to branch, each tree a world in miniature, crossing where the branches touch, now upside down, now right side up, scaling vertical trunks, then leaping where the branches give out, trailing a lifeline, and trusting to the eye and the mind to calculate distance and angle. Portia creeps forwards, judging ranges. Her branch juts out into the void, and she spends a careful minute considering whether she can make the jump to the next, before deciding that she cannot. Above her, the canopy fades out into a network of twigs that can't possibly bear her weight. Portia is far larger than her tiny ancestress, half a metre from fangs to spinnerets, an arachnophobe's nightmare. The support of her exoskeleton is aided by internal cartilage, once used for little more than muscle attachment. Her muscles are more efficient too, and some of them expand and contract her abdomen, drawing air actively over her book lungs rather than just passively taking in oxygen. This permits a boosted metabolism, regulated body temperature, and a life of swift and sustained action. Below is the forest floor, no place to be crossed lightly. There are larger predators than Portia abroad, and although she is confident in her ability to outthink them, that would involve lost time, and dusk is close. She scans her surroundings and considers her options. She has the excellent eyesight of the tiny huntress she evolved from. The great dark orbs of her principal eyes are considerably larger than those of any human. She turns her body to bring her companions into view, trusting to her peripheral eyes to warn her of danger. Bianca, the other female, is still behind at the trunk, watching Portia and willing to trust her judgment. Bianca is larger, but Portia leads, because size and strength have not been their species' most prized assets for a very long time. The third of her party, the male, is lower than Bianca, his legs spread out for balance as he hangs on the tree, looking downwards. Possibly he thinks he is keeping watch, but Portia feels he is probably just letting his mind wander. Too bad. She needs him. He is smaller than she. He can jump further and trust to more slender branches. The three of them are out of their territory by 50 days. Theirs is a species given to curiosity. That same ability that allowed their tiny ancestors to create a mental map of their environs has become the ability to imagine, to ask what is beyond the forest. Portia's people are born explorers.
She raises her palps, white side out, and signals, "Come here." No need to give him his name. Females do not refer to males by name. He catches the motion in his lateral eyes and twitches. He's always twitching. Afraid of his own shadow. Wretched creature. She has distinct opinions on him, and more complimentary ones concerning Bianca. Her world consists of over 100 individuals, mostly females, with whom she enjoys carefully maintained relationships. The nanovirus has been driving her species hard towards a communal existence. Although her brain is decidedly smaller than a human's, just as the original Portia could use her minuscule knot of neurons to accomplish remarkable things, this distant daughter has an impressive ability to solve problems. Physical, spatial, theoretical, social. Her species has proved fertile ground for the virus's attentions. Cautiously, the male crosses beneath Bianca and springs up to her branch, safety line trailing in a white thread behind him. "Bridge across," she tells him when he is close enough to communicate with properly. "Quick now." The basic content of her speech is visual, in a rapid semaphore of the palps. A wealth of context, mostly her general dissatisfaction with him, is provided in the vibrations of her flurrying feet. He flashes his humble acquiescence briefly and heads out as far along the branch as he dares, settling and resettling his feet over and over as he considers the jump ahead. Portia flashes her exasperation back to Bianca, but her companion is watching something below. An apparition, like a walking carpet, is creeping along the forest floor. Another spider, but a species that the nanovirus has managed to gift with a greater size and little else. As bulky as half a dozen Portias, it would kill her in a moment, if only it could catch her. Bianca is hungry. She indicates the ground crawler, and idly suggests they break their journey now. Portia considers, and finds the suggestion has merit. She waits until the male has made his jump across, easily, despite all his trepidation, and leaves him hauling himself back along his own line to begin the bridge work. Then she flashes a message to Bianca, and the two of them begin to descend. The hairy hunter below is intent on its own hunger. The forest is not short of prey species of varying sizes, many of them abortive results of the nanovirus's work. There are some surviving vertebrate species, mice, birds, dwarf deer, snakes. But the virus has tried and failed with them. Kern's experiment called for monkeys, and she ensured that the green planets chosen would suffer no competition from close cousins. The vertebrates that the monkeys were intended to interact with were designed to reject the virus. They have changed hardly at all. Nobody considered the invertebrates, the complex ecosystem of tiny creeping things intended to be nothing more than a scaffolding by which the absent monkeys would ascend. In so many cases, as with the great tarantula descendant below that Portia is considering, whilst the virus was able to provoke growth, the sought-for neural complexity never arose. Often, the environmental pressure to select for such a facility was simply lacking. A sense of self and the ability to contemplate the universe are not necessarily survival traits in and of themselves. Portia is a rare exception, though not the only exception, where increased cognitive capacity granted an immediate and compelling advantage. The carpet-like hunter stops, the faintest of vibrations reaching it. The forest floor is strewn with its thread, forming a messy but effective sense organ that alerts it to the movements of its prey. Against a creature as simple as this, Portia and her kin prefer hunting methods that have not changed in thousands of years. Portia has discerned the pattern of threads below, running through the leaf litter, almost hidden, save to eyes as keen as hers. She reaches down with a foreleg and plays them carefully, speaking eloquently the language of touch and motion, creating a phantom prey and giving it the illusion of size, distance, and weight entirely conjured by her skill. She places herself in the primitive mind of the ground hunter, as surely as if she could actually implant her thoughts there. It advances a handful of steps, testing out this sensation, not wholly convinced. She wonders if it has had some near escapes with her kind before. The great shaggy abdomen is up, ready to shake out a cloud of barbed hairs that will choke Portia's book lungs and irritate her joints. She reaches down gingerly again. prying and tugging, suggesting that the illusory prey is getting further away, soon to escape entirely. Her body is mottled and irregular, as her ancestors were, and the ground hunter's simple eyes have not made her out. It takes the bait suddenly, in a hairy rush across the forest floor towards nothing, and Bianca drops on its back, fangs first, driving them in where its legs meet its body, and then springing away a few body lengths to be out of the way of any riposte. The hunter lunges after her, but stumbles, even as it does so, abruptly unsteady. Moments later it is twitching and quivering as the venom takes effect, and the two females wait for it to grow motionless, though still alive, before closing in to feed. Bianca, in particular, remains taut for another leap to escape if need be, her abdomen heaving slightly in and out as she forces air past her book lungs. Up above, the male is looking down plaintively, and when Portia checks on him, he signals for permission to feed. She tells him to finish his work first. A moment later, he has dropped down practically on top of her, sending her leaping instinctively backwards, landing clumsily and flipping onto her back before righting herself angrily. Bianca has come within a whisker of killing the male, but he is stamping and signalling frantically. Danger coming! Danger! Spitters! And he is right. Here come her kind's ancestral foes. The spitting spiders, the Cytodes, have marched in step with Portia's kin all the way from their minuscule beginnings. They are somewhere between her and the ground hunter in size, but size was not the key to dominance even in the ancient days before the virus. Now she sees them creep warily forwards, a whole troop of them, six, no, eight individuals, spread out, but watching, come down off their web to hunt. They hunt in packs, these uplifted spitters, and Portia has an understanding that they are not beasts, whilst not having achieved whatever she has become. They are the big, shambling killers, constantly on the edge of Portia's world, brutal, lurking primitives whose unseen, implicit presence keeps hatchlings from straying too far from the nest. If the numbers had been equal, then Portia and Bianca would have contested the kill, for they see that the spitters have been following the path of the same prey. Eight is too many, though, even with the additional tricks the three travellers can utilise. The Cytodes will throw out their sprays of sticky, venomous webbing. Although their eyesight is weak, and Portia and her kind are smart enough to anticipate and agile enough to dodge, the sheer number of nets will make the odds of their escaping poor. Conversely, the spitters are well aware of the danger that Portia's kind poses. The two species have clashed over untold generations, each time with more understanding of the enemy. Now, both recognise that the other is something less than kin, but something more than prey. Portia and Bianca make automatic threats, lifting their forelimbs and displaying their fangs. Portia is considering whether her secret new weapon would even the odds. Her mind plays out likely scenarios, with and without the male's assistance. The enemy numbers seem too great for her to be sure of victory, and her task comes first. In her mind is a meta-plan, just the sort of A to B route-finding that her distant antecedents performed, save that her goal is not just a spatial location, but an intangible victory condition. A fight now with the spitters would likely leave her in no position to achieve what she has set out to do. She signals to the other two to fall back, making her gestures large and slow enough that the inferior eyes of the spitters will read them. Can they understand her? She does not know. She could not even say whether they have some way of communicating amongst themselves that approximates to her own visual and vibrational language. Still, they hold off. No spitting, and only a minimal threat display from them, as Portia and her cohort retreat. Bianca's feet pluck out a muttering refrain of frustration and annoyance. Being larger than Portia, she is quicker to seek physical confrontation. She is here because that has its uses, but for that same reason she knows to follow Portia's lead. They ascend once more, aware now that they must hunt again, and hope that the Cytodes clan will be satisfied with what was left here for them. Sometimes the spitters follow, if they have the numbers, and then it would be a choice of fast flight or turn and ambush. By dark, they have brought down an orb-web builder, and the male jumps on an unwary mouse, neither of which makes a hearty meal. Portia's active lifestyle and altered anatomy mean that she needs considerably more food than her predecessors, pound for pound. If they were to be forced to live by hunting alone, then their journey would take far longer than it should. Amongst her baggage, however, Bianca
has a quartet of live aphids. She lets the little creatures out to suck sap, fending the male off in case he forgets that they're not for eating, or not yet. After dusk, when Portia has spun a makeshift tent in the canopy, complete with warning lines in all directions, the aphids produce glutinous honeydew, which the spiders can drink as though it was the nourishing liquidized innards of their prey. The domesticated creatures meekly return to Bianca's webbing afterwards, understanding only that they are safe with her, not realizing that, in extremis, they themselves will become the meal. Portia is still hungry. Honeydew is subsistence stuff, nourishing without the satisfaction of taking real prey. It is difficult for her to crouch there, knowing that there are aphids and the male within reach. But she can look ahead and see that her long-term plan will suffer if those are consumed now. Her lineage has always specialized in looking ahead, and in looking beyond, too. Now she squats at the entrance to the makeshift tent forming their camp, Bianca and the male nestling beside her for warmth, and looks out through the gaps in the canopy at the lights populating the night sky. Her people know them, and see paths and patterns in them, and realize that they too move. Portia understands that their celestial journeys are predictable enough to use when navigating her own. One, though, is special. One light does not tread a slow and year-long course over the heavens, but hurries past, a genuine traveller, just as she is. Portia looks up now and sees that tiny glint of reflected light passing overhead, a solitary, motile speck in the vast dark, and she feels a kinship with it, lending to that orbiting pinpoint as much of an arachnomorphic personality as she can conceive of. Chapter 2.3 Enigma Variations. This time, they had all of Key Crew out of the morgue, Holston almost the last one to appear, stumbling on numb feet and shivering. He looked better than a lot of them, though. His little jaunt, mere moments of personal time, and over a century ago, had loosened him up. Most of the people he was now looking at had last opened their eyes while the Gilgamesh shared a solar system with the failing husk of Earth. They were crammed into the briefing room, all grey faces and shaven heads, some of them looking malnourished, others bloated. A few had pale mottling across their skins, some side effect of the sleep process that Holston couldn't guess at. He saw Guyon looking more alert than anyone else there, and guessed the mission commander had ordered himself to be woken early so that he could assert his bright, brisk dominance over this roomful of zombies. Holston checked off the departments. Command, engineering, science, and what looked like the whole of security, too. He tried to catch Lane's eye, but she barely glanced at him, nothing in her manner admitting to any century-ago liaison.
Right!
Guyon's sharp tone drew all ears as a final few stumbled in.
We're here. We've made it with 5% loss of cargo and around 3% system deterioration, according to the engineers. I consider that the greatest vindication of the human spirit and strength of will that history has ever known. You should all be proud of what we've achieved.
His tone was adversarial, certainly not congratulatory. And sure enough, he went on.
But the real work is yet to come. We have arrived, and as you all know, this was supposedly a system the old Empire Space Fleet frequented. We set our course for here because these were the closest extrasolar coordinates where we could hope to find a livable habitat and perhaps even salvageable tech. You all know the plan. We have their star maps, and there are other such locations within a relatively short journey of here. Just a short hop compared to the distances we've already travelled without mishap.
Always just 5% mishap, Holston thought, but did not say. Guyon's belief in the extent of the Imperial presence within this system was also highly speculative, from the classicist's own perspective. And even Old Empire was a maddeningly inaccurate term. Most of the others looked too groggy to really think beyond the words themselves, though. Again, he glanced at Lane, but she seemed to be focused only on the commander.
What most of you do not know is that the Gilgamesh intercepted transmissions emanating from this system on our way in, which have been identified as an automatic distress beacon. We have functioning technology.
He hurried on before anyone could get a question in.
The Gilgamesh has therefore plotted a flight path solution that will break us around the star. And on the way out, will come by slow enough for a meaningful pass close to the source of that signal, the planet there.
Now his audience started waking up, and there was a rising babble of questions that Guyan waved down.
That's right, a planet in the sweet spot, just like we were promised. It's been thousands of years, but space doesn't care. It's there, and the old Empire has left a present for us too. And that could be good, or it could be bad. We're going to have to be careful. Just so you know, the signal isn't from the planet itself, but from some sort of satellite. Maybe just a beacon, maybe something more. We're going to try and open communications with it, but no guarantees.
And the planet? Someone asked. Guyan indicated Rhenus Vetus, the head of the scientific team.
We're loath to commit so far,
the slender woman began, another who'd obviously been up for a while, or perhaps by nature unflappable.
The analysis made by Gilgamesh on our way in suggests something only slightly smaller than Earth, at close to Earth's distance from the star, and with all the right components. Oxygen, carbon, water, minerals.
So why not commit? Why not say it?
Holston identified the speaker. Big Cast, who led the security detail. His chin and cheeks were raw, red and peeling horribly, and Holston remembered suddenly how the man had refused to lose his beard for the suspension chamber, and was now apparently paying the price. I remember him arguing with engineering over that, he thought. It should have seemed just days before, according to his personal waking history, but as he had noticed last time, there was clearly something imperfect about suspension. Certainly, Holston could not feel the centuries that had passed since they abandoned Earth. But something in his mind acknowledged that lost time. The sense of a yawning, terrible wasteland. A purgatory of the imagination. He found himself reluctant to consider ever going back under.
Why, in all honesty?
Vetus replied brightly.
It's too good to be true. I want to overhaul our instruments. That planet is too Earth-like to be believed.
Looking around at all the suddenly sour faces, Holston raised his hand.
But of course it's like Earth,
he got out. The looks turned on him were not encouraging, some merely creased with dislike, but rather more with exasperation. What's the bloody classicist want now? Desperate for some attention already?
It's a terraforming project, he explained. If it's like Earth, that just shows it's finished, or near finished.
There's no evidence the ancients ever actually practiced terraforming, Vetus told him, her tone an obvious put-down.
Let me take you through the archives. It's mentioned 100 times in their writings. But instead, Holston just shrugged, recognizing the showmanship of it all.
There is, he told them. Out there. We're heading straight towards it.
Right,
Guyan clapped his hands, perhaps annoyed that he had not been listening to his own voice for 2 minutes at a stretch.
You each have your tasks, so go and make ready. Vetus, run checks on our instrumentation as you proposed. I want us to conduct a full inspection of the planet and satellite as we close. Lane, keep a close eye on ship's systems as we approach the star's gravity well. The Guild's not done anything but go in a straight line for a long time. Cast, get your people reacquainted with their kit, just in case we need you. Mason, you're working with my people on monitoring that signal. If there's anything active there to respond to us, I want to know about it.
Hours later, and Holston was almost the last person left in the communications suite, his dogged academic patience having outlasted most of Guyan's people. In his ear, the signal, full of static, still pulsed its single, simple message, clearer now than it had been out beyond the system, and yet saying no more. He had been sending responses regularly, seeking to spur something new, an elaborate academics game, where he formulated queries in formal Imperial C in the hope of seeming like the sort of caller that the beacon was crying out for. He started at a sudden movement beside him, as Lane slumped into the neighbouring seat.
How's life in engineering?
He took out the earpiece.
Not supposed to be about people management, she grunted. We're having to thaw out about 500 coffins from cargo to run repairs on them. Then we're having to tell 500 recently awoken colonists that they need to go right back into the freezer. Security have been called in. It's ugly. So, have you even worked out what it says yet? Who's in distress?
Holston shook his head.
It's not like that. Well, yes, it is. It says it's a distress beacon. It's calling for help. There are no specifics. It's a standard signal the old Empire used for that purpose,
intended to be clear, urgent, and unmistakable, always assuming you're even a member of the culture that produced it. I only know what it is because our early spacefarers were able to reactivate some of the stuff they found in Earth orbit and extrapolate function from context. So, say hi to it. Let it know we've heard it. He sucked in the breath of the annoyed academic, starting off with the same pedantic, "It's not..." before her frown made him reconsider. "It's an automated system. It's waiting for a response it recognizes. It's not like those extrasolar listening post things we used to have, searching for any kind of signal pattern at all. And even those, I was never convinced by them, by the idea that we could necessarily recognize an alien transmission for what it was. That's too rooted in our assumption that aliens will be in any way like us. It's... you understand the concept of cultural specificity. Don't lecture me, old man. It's... will you stop with that? I'm, what, 7 years older than you? 8? You're still the oldest man in the universe." Hearing that, he was very aware that he honestly did not know how the pair of them stood, one to another. So maybe I was just the last man in the universe. Right then. Or me and Guyan, at least. Apparently it doesn't matter now, anyway. "Yeah, well, you've been up for how long? Before they woke you?" he goaded her. "Keep pulling those long hours and you'll catch up real soon, won't you?" She had no ready comeback, and when he glanced at her, her face was long and pensive. "This is no way to run a civilization," he thought. "But of course, that's not what we are. Not anymore. We're a civilization in transport, waiting to happen somewhere else. Maybe here. We're the last cutting of old Earth." The pause stretched out between them, and he found he had no way of breaking its hold, until Lane abruptly shook herself and said, "So, cultural specificity. Let's talk about that." He was profoundly grateful for the lifeline. "So, I know it's a distress beacon, but that is literally only because we've had prior contact with Imperial tech, and in sufficient context that we can make assumptions. Some of which may be wrong, even. And this isn't an alien species, this is us, our ancestors. And in turn, they won't recognize our signals, necessarily. There's this myth that advanced cultures will be so expansively cosmopolitan that they'll be able to effortlessly talk down to the little people, right? But the Empire never intended its tech to be forward compatible with primitives, meaning us. Why would it? Like everyone else, they only ever intended to talk to each other. So I'm telling this thing, 'Hello, here we are,' but I don't know what protocols and what codes their system is expecting to receive from whatever rescuer would have been planned for, however many thousand years ago. They can't even hear us. We're just background static to them." She shrugged. "So what? We get there and send Cast over with a cutting torch and open her up?" He stared at her. "You forget how many people died in the early space years trying to get at Empire tech. Even with all the systems fried by their old electromagnetic pulse weapons, there were still plenty of ways for it to kill you." Another lift of the shoulders, indicating a tired woman at the edge of her reserves. "Maybe you forget how much I don't like Cast. Did I forget? Did I ever know that?" He had a vertiginous sense that maybe he had, but that any such knowledge had fallen unnoticed from his head during the long, cold age of his suspension. And it genuinely had been an age. There had been whole, discrete periods of human history that had not lasted so long. He found himself holding on to the console as though at any moment the illusion of gravity gifted by the Gilgamesh's deceleration would vanish, and he would simply slip away in some random direction, with all connection lost. These are all the people there are. With the image of that roomful of near strangers he had never had a chance to get to know before they sealed him in the coffin. This is life and society and human contact, now and forever. It seemed to be Lane's turn to find the silence awkward. But she was a practical woman. She simply got up to go, drawing away sharply as he tried to put a hand on her arm. "Wait." It came out more as a plea than he had intended. "You're here, and I need your help." "On what?" "Help me with the signal. The beacon signal. There's always been a lot of interference, but I think it's possible that there's actually a second signal clashing with it on a close frequency. Look." He passed a handful of analyses over to her screen. "Can you clean it up? Compensate it out if it's noise, or at least something? I'm running out of things to try right now." She seemed relieved at actually getting a sensible request from him,
and resumed her seat. For the next hour, the two of them worked wordlessly side by side, she with what was now her task, and he in sending increasingly desperate inquiries aimed at the satellite, none of which evinced any response. Eventually, he felt that he might as well just be sending over gibberish, for all the difference it made. Then, "Mason?" from Lane, and there was something new in her tone. "Hmm? You're right. It is another signal." A pause. "But we're not getting it from the satellite." He waited, seeing her fingers move over the panels, checking and rechecking. "It's from the planet." "Shit, you're serious?" And then, with a hand to his mouth, "Oh, sorry, I'm sorry, not language befitting the dignity of etc., but, no, no, this is definitely a shit-worthy moment." "It's a distress call? It's repeated?" "It's not like your distress signal. Much more complex. It must be actual live talk. It's not repeating." For a moment, Holston actually felt her hope peak, pulling the air between them taut with the untold potential of the future. And then she hissed, "Bollocks." "What?" "No, it is repeating. It's longer and more complicated than your distress call, but this is the same sequence again." Hands on the move once more. "And it's... we're..." Her bony shoulders sagged. "It's... I think it's bounce." "Come again?" "I think this other signal is bouncing from the planet. I... well, most likely hypothesis. The satellite is sending a signal to the planet, and we're catching bounce back." "Fuck, I'm sorry. I really thought..." "Lane, are you sure?" She cocked an eyebrow at him, because he was not joining in her dejection. "What? The satellite is communicating with the planet," he prompted. "It's not just a bounce back of the distress call. It's something longer. A different message sent to the planet than for the rest of the universe. But it's just on a loop. Same as..." She slowed down. "You think there's someone down there?" "Who knows? But they're not broadcasting. Who knows? It's a terraform world. Whatever Vetus says, it was created to be lived on. And even if the satellite is nothing but a call for help these days, if they seeded the world with people, so maybe they really are savages. Maybe they don't have the tech to receive or transmit, but they could still be there. On a world specifically made for humans to live on." She stood up suddenly. "I'm off to fetch Guyan." For a moment he looked at her, thinking, "Seriously? That was the first thing you thought of?" But he nodded resignedly, and she was off, leaving him to listen in on the newfound contact between satellite and planet, and try to work out what it signified. To his great surprise, it took him very little time to do so.
"It's what?"
Guyan demanded. The news had brought along not just the commander, but most of the key crew as well.
"A series of mathematics problems," Holston explained to them all. "The only reason it took me as long as it did was that I was expecting something more sophisticated. Something informative, like the beacon. But it's maths. Weird maths, too," Lane commented, looking over his transcription. "The sequences get quite complicated, but they're set out step by step from first principles, basic sequences." She was frowning. "It's like, Mason, you mentioned extrasolar listening posts before?"
"It's a test, yes," Holston agreed. "An intelligence test."
"But you said it was pointed at the planet,"
Cast stated.
"Which raises all kinds of questions."
"Yes," Holston shrugged. "I mean, this is very old technology. This is the oldest working tech that anyone anywhere ever discovered. So what we're seeing could just be the result of a breakdown, an error. But yes, makes you think."
"Or not,"
Lane put in dryly. When the others just stared at her, she continued in her snide tone.
"Come on, people. Am I the only one thinking it? Come on, Mason, you've been trying to get the thing to notice you for how long now? We've rounded the star on our approach to the planet, and you're still drawing blanks. So now you're saying it's setting some sort of maths test for the planet?"
"Yes, but..."
"So send in the answers," she suggested.
Holston stared at her for a long time, then glanced sideways at Guyan.
"Well, we don't know what..."
"Do it,"
Guyan ordered. Carefully, Holston called up the answers he had compiled, the early problems solved easily on his fingers, the later ones only with artificial help. He had been sending plaintive signals to the distant satellite for hours. It was simple enough to dispatch the string of numbers instead. They waited, all of the key crew. It took 7 minutes and some seconds for the message to reach its intended destination. There was some shuffling. Cast cracked his knuckles. One of the science team coughed. A little over 14 minutes after sending, the distress beacon ceased. Chapter 2.4 Poor Relations. Porsche's people are natural explorers. As active carnivores, with a considerably more demanding metabolism than their forebears, too many of them in one place will quickly overhunt any home territory. Traditionally, their family units fragment often. The females who are weakest, with the fewest allies, are the ones who venture further afield to establish new nests. Such diasporas happen regularly, for, although they lay far fewer eggs than their ancestors, and although their standards of care are far below human so that infant mortality rates remain high, the species population is in colossal expansion. They are spreading across their world, one broken family at a time. Porsche's own expedition is something different, though. She is not seeking a nesting ground, and there is a home that her present plans require her to return to. In her mind and her speech, it is the Great Nest by the Western Ocean, and several hundred of her kind, most, but not all, relatives of one degree or another, reside there. The basic domestication of the aphids and their husbandry by the spiders has allowed the Great Nest to grow to unprecedented size without the shortages that would prompt migration or expulsion. Over several generations, the social structure of the Great Nest has grown exponentially more complex. Contact has been made with other nests, each of which has its own way of feeding the modest multitudes. There has been some halting trade, sometimes for food, but more often for knowledge. Porsche's people are ever curious about the further reaches of their world. That is why Porsche is travelling now, following the paths of stories and rumours and third-hand accounts. She has been sent. The three of them are already entering claimed territory. The signs are unmistakable, not merely regularly maintained web bridges and lines amid the trees, but patterns and designs stating by sight and scent that these hunting grounds are spoken for. This is exactly what Porsche has been looking for. Ascending as high as they can go, the travellers can see that, to the north, the character of the formerly endless forest changes dramatically. The great canopy thins, fading away in patches to reveal startling stretches of cleared ground. Beyond that, there are still trees, but they are of a different species and regularly spaced, in a manner that looks jarringly artificial to their eyes. This is what they have come to see. They could simply avoid this little piece of family turf that they have come across and go look. Porsche's plan, however, the step-by-step route that she has plotted from the start of their trek to its successful conclusion, specifically calls for her to gather information. For her ancestors, this would mean painstaking visual reconnaissance. For her, it means asking questions of the locals. They proceed with caution and openly. There is a real possibility that the incumbents may chase them off. However, Porsche can mentally put herself in their place. Consider how she herself would look upon an intruder. She can think through the permutations enough to know that an aggressive or covert entrance will increase the chance of a hostile reception. Sure enough, the locals are sharp enough to spot the newcomers quickly, and curious enough to make their presence known at a distance, signalling for Porsche and her fellows to approach. There are 7 of them, 5 females and 2 males, and they have a neat nest strung between 2 trees, liberally surrounded with trip lines to warn them of any overbold visitors. Also present are a brood of at least 2 dozen spiderlings of various ages, hatched from a communal creche. Fresh from the egg, they are able to crawl and take live prey, and understand a variety of tasks and concepts without having to be taught. Probably no more than 3 or 4 of them will reach adulthood. Porsche's people lack a mammal's helpless infant stage and the maternal bond that accompanies it. Those that do survive will be the strongest, the most intelligent, and the best able to interact with others of their kind. The palp semaphore language allows for communication over 1 mile away in clear conditions, but is not suitable for complex discussions. The more subtle, step vibration speech will not travel far across the ground or down a branch. In order to hold a free and frank exchange of views, one of the local females spins a web that stretches between several trees, large enough for everyone to rest a few feet on its many anchor points and follow the conversation as it progresses. One of the locals climbs onto the web, and at her invitation, Portia joins her. "We bring you greetings from the Great Nest on the Western Ocean," Portia begins, meaning, "We are but three, but we have friends. We have travelled far and seen many things," for information is often a trade good in itself. The locals remain suspicious. They are spoken for by their largest female, who shudders upon the web and shifts her feet, saying, "What is your purpose? This is no place for you." "We do not seek to hunt," Portia states. "We do not come to settle. We shall soon return to the Great Nest. Word has come to us." Concept is expressed very clearly to their minds, vibrations twanging down a taut line. They are naturally equipped to think in terms of information transmitted at a distance. "The land beyond your land is of interest." Unrest amongst the locals. "It is not to be travelled," their leader says. "If that is so, then that is what we have come to discover. Will you tell us what you know?" More disquiet, and Portia is aware that her mental map of what is going on must have a hole somewhere, because they are reacting in a way she cannot account for. Their leader wishes to appear bold, however. "Why should we?" "We will tell you things in return. Or we have understanding to exchange." For the spiders, mere telling and understanding are two distinctly different currencies. The locals step back off the web at a signal from their leader and huddle close, keeping several eyes on the newcomers. There is a shuffling huddle of speech, softly stepped out so that it does not reach their visitors. Portia retreats as well, and her two companions join her. Bianca has no particular ideas, save that she is anticipating having to go up against the lead female, who is noticeably bigger. The male, though, surprises Portia.
"They're afraid," he suggests. "Whatever is ahead of us, they are afraid that we may stir it up, and it will attack them."
It is natural for a male to think about fear, Portia decides. That she agrees with him makes finding out the truth about their destination all the more important. At last, the locals return to the web, and negotiations resume.
"Show us your understanding," their leader challenges.
Portia signals to Bianca, who unwraps one of the docile aphids from alongside her abdomen and displays it to the skittish surprise of the locals. The little beast is milked for honeydew, and Portia wraps up a sagging parcel of the sweet stuff and deposits it in the centre of the web, where the locals approach it. Once they have tasted it, and once they understand Portia's mastery over the animals, they are more than ready to make some manner of deal. The value of an independent food source is immediately evident to them, especially given their mysterious northern neighbours, who might soon threaten their hunting grounds.
"What of these will you trade?"
the local leader asks, eagerness evident in her movements. "We have two of these beasts for those that give us a full account of what lies beyond your lands," Portia offers, knowing that this is not what the locals really wish to trade for. "Also, we have eggs, but the raising and care of these creatures requires skill, or they will die young, and you will have nothing." There is now an urgent channel of talk running between the lead female and the others, and Portia catches fragments of it along the web. They are too agitated to be careful.
"You said you could trade,"
the big female demands.
"Yes, we can trade this understanding, but we will ask for more in return."
Portia is not referring to teaching, but to something deeper, one of the secrets of her species' continuing success. The nanovirus itself is subject to variations in its transcription. It was designed that way in order to creatively accomplish its hardwired aim, to bring the host to a detected level of sophistication set by its creators, and once its victory conditions are met, to cease further assistance. Its creators included such safeguards so as to prevent their protégés continuing to develop into superhuman monkey gods. The virus was intended for a primate host, however, and so the end state that it has been programmed to seek is something that Portia labiata can never become. Instead, the nanovirus has mutated and mutated in its inbuilt quest to reach an impossible goal, the end that justifies all conceivable means. More successful variants lead to more successful hosts, who in turn pass on the superior mutated infection. From the microscopic point of view of the nanovirus, Portia and every other affected species on the planet are merely vectors for the onward transmission of the virus's own evolving genes. Long ago in Portia's evolutionary history, her species' social development was greatly accelerated by a series of mutations in the reigning infection. The virus began to transcribe learned behaviour into the genome of sperm and egg, transforming acquired memes into genetically inheritable behaviour. The economic, force-evolved brains of Portia's kind share more structural logic with each other than chance-derived human minds do. Mental pathways can be transcribed, reduced to genetic information, unpacked in the offspring, and written as instinctive understanding, sometimes concrete skills and muscle memory, but more often whole tranches of knowledge, ragged-edged with loss of context, that the newborn will slowly come to terms with throughout its early life. The process was piecemeal at first, imperfect, sometimes fatal, but more reliable with each generation as the more efficient strains of virus prospered. Portia has learned a great deal in her life, but some things she was either born with or came to her as she developed. Just as all new-hatched spiderlings can hunt and creep and jump and spin, so Portia's early moultings brought with them an innate understanding of language and access to fragments of her forebears' lives. That is now ancient history, a facility that Portia's people have possessed from back before their histories began. More recently, however, they have learned to exploit the nanovirus's enhanced capabilities, just as the virus in turn is exploiting them. "He has the understanding," Portia confirms, a flick of one palp indicating her male follower. "But we will trade like for like. You have understanding of how to live here, and the precautions you take. That is what we seek." The next moment, she realizes that she has overplayed her hand, because the big female goes very still on the web, a particular hunting stillness that signals raw aggression. "So your great nest will come to our lands after all. You are not here to hunt. And yet tomorrow, your kin intend to hunt here." Because such traded understanding would not benefit Portia herself, but only generations to come, those whose genomes are as yet unwritten. "We seek understanding of all places," Portia protests. But the language of motion and vibration is a hard one to dissemble in. Enough unintended body language leaks into it to confirm the suspicions of the big female. Abruptly, the local leader has reared up, two pairs of legs raised high, and her fangs exposed. It is a brute language unchanged for millions of years. "See how strong I am." Her rear legs are bunched, ready to spring. "Reconsider." "Back off," Portia warns her. She herself is tensed up, but she is not showing submission, nor retreating, nor measuring her legs against the others.
"Go now, or fight,"
the angry female demands. Portia notes that she does not necessarily have the wholehearted support of her fellows, who are anxiously flagging up concern or sending cautioning words along the strands of the web. Portia creeps sideways and feels a new dancing from behind her, a charging advance from Bianca that also serves as a kind of battle hymn. The local leader is obviously thrown by the fact that her opponent's speaker is not also their fighter, and she backs off a little, warily. Moreover, Bianca has armour. There is a functional limit to how much understanding any individual can inherit from the virus. New information rewrites the old, though perhaps each generation's ability to store such innate knowledge is a little greater than the last. This band of backwoods locals will have a handful of tricks all their own, carefully preserved down the years. Their individuals can learn and teach, but their inbuilt knowledge base is limited. A larger community like Great Nest has a great many understandings to draw upon, different lineages passing on their mysteries and trading with others. Different discoveries, tricks, and knacks can be combined and experimented with. Great Nest is more than the sum of its parts. Bianca is no artisan, not by learning nor by inherent understanding, but she wears the fruits of others' labours. Curved wooden shields she has glued to her palps, dyed in aggressive, clashing colours. She rears high, measuring legs against the big female, but then hunches down, her shields raised. They fight in the manner of their kind. They display, threaten, bare their fangs. They dance across the web, each step sounding like a goading word. The local female is larger, and she knows how this goes. Her greater size will convince the smaller intruder to back down, because otherwise the newcomer will die. Portia's kin share something with tool-using man. They are very able to harm each other. They were spider killers from the first, and their venom will immobilize an enemy of their own species as easily as it would a spitter. If matters come to that, usually the victor will give in to instinct and feed. For this reason, they have a culture that shies away from actual violence because of the risks inherent in any clash. The danger they pose to one another has been a great civilizing influence, just as much as has that sense of kinship their shared viral heritage gifted them with. But Bianca is not backing down, however clearly her opponent outmatches her. The threat displays become more and more aggressive, the big female leaping and darting about the web, whilst Bianca sidles sideways and keeps her shields up against the eventual pouncing strike that must be coming. Portia, for her part, spins her thread and readies herself to use another Great Nest innovation. This one new enough that she has had to learn it, though perhaps she may be able to virally gift it to her offspring. The big female springs just as Portia is ready. Bianca takes the fang strike on her shields, the impact knocking her over onto her back. The female rears up for another strike, infuriated. The stone that strikes her knocks her clean off the web, tumbling down to hang by her safety line, twitching and convulsing. Her abdomen is cracked open on one side where the missile tore through, and the loss of fluid to her body is already causing her remaining limbs to curl in upon themselves involuntarily. Portia has already reloaded, the slingshot of silk strung in a taut V between her wide-placed front feet and her powerful hind legs. The locals stare at her. A couple have crept part way towards their injured leader, but Bianca is ahead of them, dropping to drive her fangs into her victim's cracked carapace. Portia assesses the locals. They have adopted a submissive posture, thoroughly cowed. One of the other females, not the largest, but perhaps the boldest, steps deferentially onto the web. "What do you want?" she dances out. "Good. Let us trade," Portia states, as Bianca rejoins her. "Tell us about your neighbours." After they are done, each side weighing what it is willing to share against the relative bargaining power of the other party, Portia's male scuttles onto the web and distills his understanding of aphid husbandry into a neatly silk-wrapped packet of sperm. One of the local males performs a similar service with his own day-to-day knowledge of his family's territory and its aggressive neighbours. This active use of the viral transcription is not behaviour prompted by the virus itself, but a cultural tradition amongst Portia's people. Information as currency, by means of a transfer that incidentally assists the virus in propagating its genetic code. At the same time, the next generation of spiderlings will share kinship. A bridge between Portia's great nest and this little family, part of a great web of such interrelations whose connections can be traced, community to community, across much of the planet. What the locals now say about the North is alarming, a potential threat that Portia's great nest seems likely to encounter quite soon. At the same time, it is intriguing, and Portia decides that the plan requires a closer personal look. Chapter 2.5 All These Worlds Are Yours. The reply that came back from the satellite was not intentionally encoded, but Holston still sweated over what seemed to him an age, trying to turn the radio signal into something comprehensible. In the end, it gave up its secrets under the combined might of Lane, the Gilgamesh, and himself, presenting him with a curt, brief message in classical Imperial C that he could at least make a stab at translating. Finally, he leant back in his seat, aware that all eyes were fixed on him. "It's a warning," he told them.
It's saying that we're transmitting from incorrect coordinates or something like that. It says we're forbidden here.
It looks as though it's warming up,
observed one of the science team, who had been taking readings from the distance.